fearfully and wonderfully made. Those were the words that jumped out at me when I was reading this scripture for the first time and when I was sitting with it. And I thought I would start by putting the question out to you, because I feel like this psalm really resonated with me. I feel like it probably resonates with you. We've sung It's a Wonderful World, and so I'm just interested in hearing some ideas that you shout out. How do you know that you're fearfully and wonderfully made? Anyone? Is it just me? Okay, hang on. I had the miracle of birth. Yes. Was that from Christine? Someone looking for it, Christine. Okay. Someone else was over here. Our fragility, and yet we're, and strength, and yet we're here. Yeah.
Our talents.
I got to hold a newborn baby this week, and I was just in awe of this creature. I couldn't get over it. It had only been breathing on its own for a little more than 30 days. Can you imagine that? Its eyes were still adjusting to contrasts of light and shadow. Its skin was still getting used to the feel of air and cloth. It didn't do anything as I held it and took in its shock of hair and its tiny translucent fingernails and its toes, no bigger than pearls of barley. It didn't say anything. It hadn't accomplished anything. And yet I was in awe, fearfully and wonderfully made. And you know, we're going through 2 liters of milk a day at our house right now. And running shoes that were bought last spring weren't the right size to go back to school, and pant cuffs are sitting 2-3 inches above the ankle. And after school, out come eggs, bread, cheese, ham, all of the fridge onto the counter. It's just a little snack before dinner, Mom. And I don't worry that they won't be hungry when supper comes. Fearfully and wonderfully made, these teenagers who are growing before my eyes like plants in a summer garden. They're blossoming and they're blooming, and I look up at one of them now when I go to give him a hug, and I look in the eyes of another, wonderfully made. And this summer I was with my grandmother, sat beside her on her porch, and I noticed her hands had changed. Her fingers had become fused like this. Look at these hands, she said, exasperated. She made a fist with one, and she'd run it over the palm of her hand. I can't even straighten them anymore, she said. But I looked at those fingers, and I couldn't help but marvel how fearfully and wonderfully made, Grandma, those fingers. They would stroke my face, and you would help me fall asleep. And they used that rough washcloth to scrub my skin to shining, and they'd slice peaches for crisps and jams and pies, fearfully and wonderfully made, all of this creation. But I want to raise another point. And that is that I don't think fearful and wonderful have anything to do with normal. I want to tell you a story. I had just finished my second year of theological college when I found myself struck by a mysterious ailment. I was spending the summer working as a chaplain at Credit Valley Hospital, hardly a physically demanding job, But I'd arrive home at the end of the day, and I'd be so exhausted I would go right to bed. And I would sleep seriously all evening and to the next morning, and I'd wake up and I could barely get out the door. I was so tired, and I was always hungry. My supervisor at the hospital had a cupboard full of snacks, stuff I'd normally avoid, like crackers and cheese whiz, and she said, "Help yourself if you get hungry," and I ate her entire supply. And I became so consumed by the need for juice that seriously, one day I found the nearest grocery store, and I walked to the juice aisle, and I downed an entire liter, brought the empty carton to the till, and marched next door to the drugstore to pick up a pregnancy test. I was almost 26 years old, not exactly a teenager, but I wasn't married. And that would end up causing me some problems. I didn't fit people's image of a normal minister in training. I started an internship at a congregation that fall. Parents were concerned about the message I was sending to youth. One woman wanted a meeting, ostensibly to talk about her daughter, but over the course of our conversation, it became clear that the woman was really worried about my influence. Another member pulled me aside after an evening program. "We've been talking," she said, "and the group of us don't think you should be in this role, being pregnant. It's just not normal." I was completely humiliated. I gave the sermon at the Christmas Eve service. I labored for hours to find just the right words, but I needn't have bothered. At 7 months pregnant, my body proclaimed its own message loud and clear. "I've had sex, and I'm not married, and I'm training to be a moral leader." I didn't need anyone in the congregation to explain why I ought to be ashamed. I wasn't proud. I used to take the only ring I had and twist it around so the fake jewel faced my palm and the band faced out, a kind of surrogate wedding ring. I knew I hadn't followed the normal course. And still the words of Psalm 139 felt like my words. "Lord, you have searched me, and you know me. You are familiar with all of my ways. You hem me in, behind and before. I praise you, because I am fearfully and wonderfully made." I don't share this story with you to elicit sympathy or to shock you. I share it because it's the most personal experience I have with being judged not normal. Normal. It seems such an inane word, benign, but it's so incredibly powerful. To be normal is to conform to a standard somebody else set and therein derive worth. "You're normal," society says. "Therefore, you are fearfully and wonderfully made. But if you're not, well..." I had made a choice, and I was living with consequences that put my body outside the realm of what people considered normal for my profession. It was a painful time. I questioned myself, my worth, why I didn't line up, hadn't lined up with everybody else. My body put me outside what was considered normal for a while. But after I gave birth, I was able to integrate back in. And this isn't the experience for people whose bodies are declared permanently different, outside, according to somebody else's standard of normal. And not because of choices they may have made, but because of the fundamentals of who they are, their race, their ethnicity, their sexuality, their religion. The billboards appeared in Toronto and Vancouver, Edmonton and Halifax. "Say no to mass immigration," they read. The print in bright red letters beside the face of the leader of the People's Party of Canada. I went to the party's website. "Immigration should not be forced, used forcibly, to change the cultural character and social fabric of our country," it says. I take from this that the People's Party of Canada has a concept of what's normal, what's standard, what's fearfully and wonderfully made, what they call the cultural character and social fabric of our country. And the statement on their website implies that certain immigrants to Canada force the country to deviate from this norm. When the majority of current immigrants to Canada are from India, the Philippines, China, and Syria, I take it to mean that the People's Party sees the presence of these bodies as contributing to Canada becoming not normal, forcibly changed. We need the right kind of immigrants, the party says in its platform. They never define the standard they envision in this word, right. But we can extrapolate that the party sees something wrong in the bodies of immigrants currently moving to Canada and what unites them. People from India, from the Philippines, from China, from Syria. What unites them except for the fact that they are not white? I started watching a series on Netflix, When They See Us, it's called. It takes place in New York in the 1990s. It's based on the true story of five boys wrongfully convicted of rape and assault because they didn't fit the norm, the standard. They weren't considered fearfully and wonderfully made. The investigators' conception of innocent didn't include them. The boys were just 14, 15, 16, arrested because they happened to be in Central Park the same evening that a white woman jogging there was raped. No physical evidence ever connected them to the crime, but the conception of their bodies as not conforming to a norm, to a standard, played a role in their arrest. "We were convicted by the color of our skin," said Yusuf Salam, one of the boys and now a 45-year-old man. The boys were black, but the investigators of the crime couldn't pair the norm and standard of innocence with bodies that were not white. When I read the words of Psalm 139, they seem to me the words of a person or people who know what it feels like to not be considered normal. They seem to me, in their subtext, to be the words of a person who does not conform to a certain standard, a person considered somehow less worthy of care and protection, of receiving the benefit of the doubt, a person familiar with judgment. It's a psalm originally attributed to David, who was overlooked originally to be king because he was the youngest son, not normal. The words of the psalm are thousands of years old. We don't know the original author, but we do know that those who first spoke and sang these words in temple worship experienced life in bodies deemed, for the most part, not to meet the standard. The Hebrew body wasn't revered or celebrated as the norm to which all other bodies aspired. They weren't fearfully and wonderfully praised by the societies around them. The Hebrews were not the members of the most powerful kingdom of their time. They weren't the Assyrians or the Babylonians or Romans, people who set the standards of citizenship. The Hebrews counted themselves descendants of a people who traced their ancestors to slaves and who came to the promised land from Egypt, from Africa. Later, they were forced to migrate to new lands as captives. Most of their recorded history in the Bible is a history of migrants, of refugees. Their bodies and their practices were deemed foreign and placed them outside what was considered dominant and normal in the lands of their exile. And yet the words in Psalm 139 convey an innate sense of worth, not tied to conforming to anyone's standard. "You have searched me and you know me," they would have sang to the creator of the universe. "You know when I sit and when I rise. You are familiar with all of my ways. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made." I've been wondering how exactly the Hebrews could have a sense of being so known and cared for, how they could have felt so hemmed in and knit together. How can people who've experienced what it's like to live in bodies that don't line up, people with firsthand experience of prejudice, of the pain of not being considered normal and worthy according to some outside standard, how can people who have such experiences still claim themselves to be fearfully and wonderfully made, especially when others don't treat them as such? I wonder if it's ever happened to you that you've had an experience in your body that puts you outside the standard for a while. Perhaps you notice that your friends have started to tiptoe around you. That time when you knew that what society considered normal and the experience you were having in your body didn't line up. Maybe you'd experienced a loss, and you were suddenly sad in a world where everyone around you seemed to be happy. Or maybe you'd had your heart broken in a world where the standard is to be coupled. Maybe you'd just been through a divorce, and all of your friends were still married. Maybe you were out of work, and everyone you knew had a job. Maybe you were sick, and everyone around you was well. Whatever it is, I wonder if you've ever had that experience of your body, your being, not conforming to someone else's definition of normal. And yet, when you think back on the experience, what strikes you isn't your body's sense of what it lacked, but its incredible capacity. When you think back, what strikes you about the experience is your body's capacity for healing and your body's capacity for growth Your body had a built-in resiliency. It could conjure up virtue, patience, and courage, and hope. Your body made connections. You found a way through. And at the end, there was nothing you could say but, "I am fearfully and wonderfully made." You proclaimed it. Not because you conformed to some outside idea of normal, but because you'd witnessed in yourself the innate and the sacred, you, as conceived by your Creator, strong and brave and full of capacity, fearfully and wonderfully made. I noticed the plaque when I dropped my son off on the first day of school, white letters, and they'd been painted by a child onto a small wooden heart and fixed to the fence that surrounded the playground. "No one is superior or inferior," the words read. "No one is equal. Everyone is unique and incomparable. You are you. I am I." I could have added, "fearfully and wonderfully made." It was an incredibly affirming and positive statement, a challenge to the supremacy of normal and the pain it causes and the lives it stunts. We are fearfully and wonderfully made, not because we fit some definition, but because you can't keep our bodies down. We are fearfully and wonderfully made, and let our bodies bear witness to this. God calls us to challenge the normal. You cannot keep these bodies down. Amen.